Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here. And more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With her latest novel, The Falls, writer Joyce Carol Oates takes a character literally over Niagara Falls, then tracks his widowed bride from her interrupted honeymoon to the toxic pits of Love Canal. The Washington Post calls The Falls hypnotic. The Los Angeles Times says it shows that redemption, if not inevitable, is at least one of life's options. Joyce Carol Oates grew up on a farm in Lockport, New York, 20 miles from Niagara Falls. She went to the same one-room schoolhouse her mother had attended, and later to Syracuse University and the University of Wisconsin. She won the National Book Award in 1970 for her novel, Them, about a broken family in the Detroit slums. Since 1978, she's taught creative writing at Princeton University. Her output of fiction and poetry has been enormous. In more than 30 novels, including national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys and Blonde, Oates has explored many faces of taboo and of American family dysfunction. Her latest novel, The Falls, is no exception. The novel begins with a man on his honeymoon running past a gatekeeper, climbing a railing, and throwing himself into Niagara Falls. And that's just the first few pages. Later tonight, we'll look back on the life of actor Christopher Reeve. But first, On Point, Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel, The Falls, and her long career exploring American life and families on the brink. You can join the conversation. Have you gone over the falls with the cascade of novels from Joyce Carol Oates? Are you a fan? What keeps you coming back? And how do you read Joyce Carol Oates' portrayal of the American family? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Joyce Carol Oates. She is winner of the National Book Award and the Penn Malamud Award for a lifetime of literary achievement. She's distinguished professor of humanities at Princeton University. Her new novel is The Falls. Joyce Carol Oates, good evening and welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Niagara Falls, very powerful. I've seen it myself. You grew up near it. Do you remember your first memories of Niagara Falls?
I saw it so many times as a girl and subsequently as an older teenager that they kind of all mingled together. But if I were to see it right now, I think I'd have the same feeling of awe and astonishment. It is truly an amazing phenomenon. If people haven't seen Niagara Falls, there's really no way to explain it. It's just one of those wonders of the world that takes you out of yourself. Whatever thoughts you were having before you approached the falls just sort of are swept away, and you feel very finite and very oddly connected in a way with nature. And what interests me and excited me as a novelist about this novel was that the falls as a phenomenon of nature is in such contrast to the city of Niagara Falls, which has become so industrialized and despoiled. The two are really a violent contrast.
Joyce Carol Oates, you've written so much. Did you know, have you known that Niagara Falls was waiting somewhere in your memory banks to be addressed, to be a star in one of your novels?
I had never written about Niagara Falls before, just the last couple of years. I wrote a novella called Rape, a Love Story, which is set in the city of Niagara Falls. It has very little to do with the falls itself. But for some reason, my imagination just seems to be turning in that direction. I think that with the concern for the environment and ecology today, Niagara Falls, with its disastrous Love Canal, is a kind of natural emblem of what went wrong in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. And so when I look back upon my own life, that stands out as an obvious symbolic area that I had not yet written about.
I know what you mean about the tension between the city there, which is so run down, and the falls, which are just so absolutely overpowering.
But this is a Joyce Carol Oates novel, and so the story, well, it gets dark quickly. I was thinking my own grandparents honeymooned at those falls earlier, maybe 1925, not 1950. Lucky for them, they weren't in one of your novels.
Well, it's true, but many, many people honeymooned at the falls going back into the 19th century. My novel begins in the 1950s. It begins with a kind of mythic Niagara Falls, a sort of a fairy tale aura about the early chapters where everything's a little larger than life. A woman who is widowed on her wedding night, it's almost the material of a fairy tale or of a legend. And then for 7 days and seven nights, she's wandering on the Niagara Falls, on the Niagara River banks, with the Coast Guard and rescue workers looking for this drowned man. This sort of thing could possibly happen, but it does seem to suggest fairy tale or myth and legend. Then the novel keeps moving onward through the decades and becomes more and more of a realistic narrative, and the characters are more, I think, more plausible or more lifelike. It isn't that Aurelia isn't plausible, it's just that she becomes a tabloid heroine, the widow bride of the falls.
Yeah, Aurelia, of course, and she's briefly wed to Gilbert Erskine, who goes over the falls in the very first few pages of the book. And as you say, it has, by structure, kind of a fairy tale feeling about it. But it's a very dark fairy tale from the beginning. He's conflicted about his sexuality. She's a pretty hardened spinster, or at least begins that way, but seems to open up in the course of this book. And then this arc from the falls to Love Canal over those decades, you get into a very big palette all of a sudden. Do you see those as poles in this novel, Joyce Carol Oates, the Love Canal and the Niagara Falls?
Well, Love Canal is connected with Niagara Falls in the sense that Love Canal is the repository of all sorts of toxins, even radioactive waste. Love Canal was never a canal. It was more like a trench, a long trench, a ditch that was filled with these poisonous wastes. And it's because of the falls and the power generated by the Niagara River that Niagara Falls became such an affluent manufacturing area. So the falls generates the power, and then the power made possible this industrialization of a certain part of upstate western New York. So the two go together. And I begin in the 1950s because that's post-war, and that's when all sorts of expansion took place in America, all kinds of building and development, industrialization of all kinds. Things really began to change in the United States after World War II. And also in that era, since I'm writing about family life and love and human relations, that era, which sort of dissolves in the mid and late 1960s, was a time of sexual repression and a time when virginity was a very high ideal, chastity for women, but it was bound up with willful ignorance. So a good woman or girl was virtually somebody who knew nothing at all about sex, about normal erotic love. And these poor women and girls would just get married, and often the marriages were disasters from the start because they're based on all kinds of naive romantic assumptions. Women were so desperate to get engaged in those days. We have to remember that this was many decades ago. Most women had no professions, and they didn't have much hope of professions, and they were shunted into getting married. I think about the only jobs a woman could anticipate might be elementary school teaching or maybe music teaching or library work, and they were very badly paid.
And that's clearly the persona you've got here with Aurelia. I was struck, in the 80s, you did a series of novels in a Gothic style, starting with Belfleur. Here you begin in 1950, but I wonder how time gets established. I mean, you present such a kind of, prissy naivete in Aurelia at the beginning of this book, and then all that 19th century aura of the falls, the late 19th century hotels there. Until I read 1950 in the book, I felt like I was in the 19 teens or something. How do you decide how to frame a particular time? And does your kind of affinity for the Gothic make the 1950s seem like the 19-teens?
Well, it's hard to answer that. I think the 1950s in some ways were extremely repressed. It was not a time when we had much consciousness of sexual mores. The idea of a gay culture did not exist. Homosexuality, if it was even thought of at all, was considered extremely psychopathological. And if you thought you were homosexual, which you wouldn't allow yourself to think, you'd have to go to a psychiatrist because you would feel that you were very sick. We have lost all those, I mean, most of us anyway, have lost those predilections today. So it was completely a different era.
People don't go over the falls over that issue now, or at least not usually. I wish you'd take us through the highlights of this unfolding of Araya's family in the years that follow. She very quickly marries a prominent attorney in town, Dirk Burnaby, what a name, and has a family that charges through this history, ultimately brought low by love. Now, can you give us a sense of how this family unfolds?
The idea of Dirk Burnaby has been with me for quite a while. I wanted to write about a man who was altruistic and protective of those he perceived as weak. He is very protective of Araya when he meets her. He is a member of a kind of aristocratic family. He has money in his background. At the same time, he's egalitarian in the sense that he has real sympathy for people who are disadvantaged. And there have been people like him in America, lawyers who become involved in this kind of litigation, class action suits. And often in the early generations of this kind of litigation, as in the case of Love Canal, the early people who were involved in it were really selfless. They really were courageous. They were like soldiers, pioneers in the field. Mm. Today you have lawyers who take on class action suits against the big pharmaceutical companies or tobacco companies, and they're not risking nearly, I mean, they're not risking probably anything at all. And with their contingency fees, they make a lot of money.
But I'm struck, just let me interject. In your typical style, it may be selflessness that originally takes this attorney to represent people who live above Love Canal, whose families are being destroyed by the chemicals there. But it's a lot more than selflessness. I mean, as you write, you say he would destroy himself and his marriage in the doomed cause of Love Canal, and it's not long until he's in the cemetery with a mother whose family's been tortured by that toxicity, making love in a graveyard. This is not exactly just just a savior on a selfless mission.
Well, that isn't Dirk. That's his son, Royal.
Oh, excuse me. Of course. Right.
It's somebody different. But I think what you're saying is that Dirk is a flawed person. Oh, yes, he's certainly flawed. The people who are that have that much energy and that much identification with others are often very flawed. And one of his problems is that he overreaches. He overextends. He thinks that he's stronger than he is. And somebody says later, after he's dead, somebody who's taken up the litigation in the 1970s said that Dirk Burnaby had underestimated the power of the enemy. He looked at these men and he saw men who looked like himself, and he didn't understand the moral rot of that society.
These men who were defending the creators of Love Canal, in effect.
Yeah, and I did research into this, and it's just astonishing. You'll have medical examiners, coroners, newspaper editors, university professors, chemists, all sorts of scientists who are expert witnesses. And one after another, they will say that there isn't any connection between the leukemia and other and miscarriages and other illnesses that people are suffering and the chemical wastes. And we know today, of course, there are. It's just that the establishment had so bought out these people. For many years, I think the local newspapers just didn't have any sympathy for what the people were doing. So I became very incensed myself when I was doing the research. My grandfather, who was my mother's father, died of emphysema in what was obviously a work-related environment in a steel mill in Tonawanda, New York, which is right near. It's very close to Niagara Falls. Yeah. And when my grandfather died, this is some time ago, of course, there wasn't any consciousness that he was dying because of a work-related illness. He just died. And we thought they would. They said about him, well, it was his time. You know, he was an old man.
This was the way of the world.
And he was only about 52. Ah. You know, like he wasn't an old man at all. It's just that his lungs were filled with this iron filings. He died a horrible death.
Joyce Carol Oates, stand by. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with novelist Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel, The Falls, and her career-long exploration of American life and American families. On The Brink, you can join the conversation. Have you gone over the falls with the cascade of novels from Joyce Carol Oates? Are you a fan? What keeps you coming back? And what about Niagara Falls? Have you stood at the edge and felt the power? Did you feel the urge to jump? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist Joyce Carol Oates. Her new novel is The Falls. You can join us tonight. How do you absorb the reach and extremes of Joyce Carol Oates' fiction? How do you read her portrayal of the American family? What's your question for novelist Joyce Carol Oates? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kathy's calling from Hamburg, New York. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I just wanted to tell you, Ms. Oates, that I've been a fan of yours for about 32 years since I was in college, and that I really enjoy your books because every book is different. You don't have, like, one certain theme or anything, and so I look forward to your books. And two of my favorites were Zem and The Black Water. I enjoy that. And what I also like is because you write about Western New York a lot of times, and I know a lot of the places that you've wrote about and everything. And I went to Williamsville South High School, too.
You did? Oh,
yes,
that's great.
I did.
Yes. Well, I wrote
Isn't
a novel
where
called...
you went? Did you go there, or did you go to Lockport?
No, I went to Williamsville South, but I wrote a novel called Brokart Blues, which is sort of about Williamsville.
It was very good. I really enjoyed it. Slipped my mind what it was called because I've read.
Right. Kathy, let me ask you, what was it about Blackwater that you so liked? Of course, this is the one that seems to refer to Chappaquiddick. What did it bring you?
That's what I liked about it. I liked the way she told the story and everything. You know, it just really held my interest. I couldn't put the book down or anything. It's just so well written. You felt like you were right there, you know, with the senator and everything and, you know, the people he was talking to. I just really enjoyed it.
And when the critics say, Kathy, that Joyce Carol Oates, I mean, when they point out that she focuses so often on what's violent and taboo and kind of family dysfunction, is that illuminating for you as a reader?
Yes, it is. I find it very interesting because, you know, not all the things she writes about, people want to talk about or that, and it's really interesting, and you get a different point of view by reading, you know, her books, because you really get a wide variety of things to learn about, you know, and everything. I really enjoy it.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call. Terrific to have you. Joyce Carol Oates, how about it? This, you say you've got I'm reading here in an interview you did with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You're talking about a kind of tragic optimism. Within that, you're often drawn to the brutal, the violent, the taboo breaking. Was it a conscious decision? Is it just what you're drawn to as an artist? How do you end up there?
Well, as an American writer of some seriousness, naturally I'm trying to reflect my society, and it wouldn't be a very plausible mirror on reality if I wrote about things that were not, didn't reflect the turmoil of our times. It's a heavily politicized time. And even now we're even at war, but we've often been a very bellicose nation, and we have a predilection for firearms and for a certain kind of pioneer violence. Frontier, the myth of the frontier is still very much part of our culture. So as an American writer, naturally, I would write about those subjects. But I do have optimism. I was thinking that in terms of, in the long run, when you look upon the history of nations going back virtually to prehistoric times, we have to concede that man is very bellicose and that there have always been wars, devastating things that human beings have done to one another. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And yet we do feel that there has been some progress. There are some areas of humanity and ethics and medical technology and science. We do feel that there is some progress. And so to that degree, I do feel optimistic. And also I tend to feel very optimistic about human relations in a smaller way, in maybe communities rather than nation states. Nation states get very large and impersonal. And often, if you look around the world today, you see that the nation states are not always benign to their own citizens. Mm. But within the family group or the extended family and within friendships and the workplace and professions, I think there can be bonds of genuine altruism and sympathy.
We're at 1-800-423-8255 with novelist Joyce Carol Oates. 1-800-423-TALK. Steve's calling from Danbury, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to
and
have
Ms. Oates, I feel privileged to be talking to you. I just recently became acquainted with your writing, actually. My mother recommended that I read Middle Age, a Romance, and it was sardonic. It was brilliant. I enjoyed every page from beginning to end. So,
thank you.
Of course, I had to go out and get another one of your novels, and I ended up picking up We Were the Mulvaneys. Enjoyed that thoroughly as well. Just excellent writing. I'm amazed that I hadn't read any of your stuff previously. What I'd like to know is, what should I read next?
Thanks.
Well, that's a good question. I guess The Falls might interest you. It is a family novel, and it depends upon whether you like short stories, because I write a lot of short stories, and I love short stories, too.
Well, I actually knew of your prolific short story writing, and had for years and years read of your short stories, and just had never gotten around to any of them, so I would like to try some of the short stories, but you think The Falls would be a natural follow-up to Middle Age and The Mulvaneys?
Well, it probably would be, and my most recent book of stories is called I Am No One You Know.
It sounds like there's a lot for you to dig into there, Steve. Thanks for your call. 37 novels now, 23 volumes of short stories, 7 volumes of poetry, 4 volumes of plays, and on it goes. Plenty from Joyce Carol Oates. Thanks for calling, Steve. Susan's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Hello, Susan. Are you there? Yeah, looks like we lost Susan. Come back to us, Susan. Joyce Carol Oates, I wonder if you can describe a direction or an evolution that you could articulate in the arc of your focus, in where you're headed in your writing, in what grabs your attention. Is there a direction to it?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I first began writing, when I was quite young in my 20s, I was focusing on rural upstate New York, and I had not yet lived in a big city. And then I moved to Detroit, Michigan, and began working on novels that were set in urban centers in the United States. That seemed to be emblematic of the United States in a very interesting way, of the politics and the culture.
And Detroit early on.
Yeah, very much in Detroit. And then I moved on to other parts of the country. I live now near Princeton, New Jersey, where I teach at Princeton University, and I've written about that area quite extensively, though I still write about upstate New York.
But in terms of subject matter or theme, do you feel yourself growing in a direction that you can describe or not?
I don't know how to answer that. There's a certain trajectory, I think, that someone might see in an impersonal way, but the writer herself sort of moves, I think, intuitively. I tend to be driven by characters, and I'm very interested in the interplay between characters and place. And I'm not necessarily aware of the theme of a work. My next novel is called Missing Mom, and it's about a woman whose mother dies, and the 1 year following that, the woman mourns her mother and is learning to live without her mother. It's a very female-oriented novel that only one or two men have read it so far in manuscript, and they say that they can identify with it, but I was very surprised. So I would have thought that was moving in a direction of women's writing, because it seemed to be focused on the subject that women would be able to relate to. The devastation that a woman feels when she loses her mother, which may be equivalent to what a man feels when he loses his mother. I can't speak for that, because I am a woman and I lost my mother 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's about that really unanticipated, astonishing feeling that you have when you've lost your mother.
Well, with Joyce Carol Oates at 1-800-423-8255. Susan is calling from Brookline. We've got you. Susan, thanks for calling.
Hello, Miss Oates.
Hello.
Hi. I just felt that I had to say to you that I read years and years ago, I think it was either your first or your second book, The Garden of Earthly Delights. And I then think I read the next one, if I remember correctly, and if I'm on course here, it was Expensive People. And when I read those two books at the same, you know, within a very short period of time, and I saw how absolutely beautifully you were able to write in completely different styles about different subjects. And when I, as an aspiring writer myself at that time, I just said to myself, she's going to win the National Book Award next year. And
oh, my.
Whether it was a National Book Award or not, that year, I know that you did almost to the day when I was thinking about it. And I was so happy because I had enjoyed those books and I just recognized your talent so completely that I was fully invested in you getting that National Book Award.
Susan, what is it about Joyce Carol Oates' writing that made you feel so drawn?
Oh, she's just superb. She just understands her characters, and she has a wide imagination, and she's everything that a writer should be in lots of ways. Not that there aren't other writers, too, but your breadth of understanding of different people, of different modes of thought, of different lives, is stupendous, and I admire you very much.
Well, thank you.
Joyce Carol Oates, Susan, spotted you early on. Did you know yourself? I mean, I'm reading here that you were 14, you got your first typewriter and began writing novels immediately. You've written an incredible volume since then. Did you know that this would be your life? Did you? And how? Why?
I don't think anyone really anticipates what will evolve. I think that we're drawn in a kind of groping in an intuitive way to do what excites us. Telling stories is very natural. Everyone has stories to tell. Not everyone takes time to write them down or to find a language and a structure for them. But I think we all know people who are wonderful storytellers, and they're just bubbling and brimming with tales. And we know many fascinating personalities who are real characters. Mm. It's just that very few people will take the time, and it does take time. It takes some discipline. Very few people take the time to set this down in a work of art.
Jason is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that, Ms. Oates, I've just recently become a fan of yours. I read a few stories of yours in college, and that was sort of my question I had for you. I had read one of your stories for a Women in Lit class that I took, Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been? And I had not read any of your work previous to this, and I love characterization, and one of the main things I love about reading is reading in depth on characters. And to be honest, I had come right away up with the young man in the story who shows up with a car and the numbers, that he was the devil, or the devil incarnate of people. And my professor had never heard this, and it was talked about in class, but she talked to me after class that she had read your story for many years, and she had never thought of that. I honestly didn't want to be contrite, but I wanted to ask you what you thought of that.
Well, he certainly is based on some sort of otherworldly, almost fairy tale and malevolent character. When I first wrote that story, it had a working title of Death and the Maiden, and he was a form of death. And there are English and Scottish ballads where Death is riding a horse through a forest, and he sees a young maiden, and he takes the maiden on his horse, and they ride off, and it's an emblem of death. And so Arnold Friend in the story has that role. Instead of having a horse, he has a car because it's 20th century America.
Sure.
But
sure.
Definitely, I didn't mean him to be literally the devil because I don't believe in the devil, but he has a demonic power. And we say traditionally that the devil doesn't exist in himself, but he tempts other people. So this is a person who's a tempter.
Jason, it sounds like you're on the right track there. Keep reading.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling. I want to get to another call here, but thanks very much for calling in, Jason. Patty is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi, Ms. Oates. I love your novels. Like everyone calling, I had my own favorites. Zombie was particularly effective to me. It shook me. Reading that book, when I put it down, I had to compose myself. It was just a wonderful book. But
this is The Serial Sex Killer in 1995.
Yes, and the way she was able to get into his brain, it sort of scares me about you, Ms. Oates. What's going on there? But my question was, I was just interested in her thoughts on the way that the novel is evolving in different ways these days, like graphic novels in particular. What are her thoughts on it, and would she ever think of either drawing a graphic novel herself if she has that talent or collaborating on one?
Thanks, Patty.
I think graphic novels are very interesting, and they can be extremely dark and subtle, and the drawings can be really quite beautiful. Yes, I like them. I've seen a few. I don't want to name any names because I would leave out some crucial names, which I don't want to do. But I would not be drawing this myself. It would be adapted by an artist, you know, who really knows what he's doing. I am actually looking into that, and I'm possibly going to be working with an editor on a graphic novel.
Oh, boy, picture that.
I wrote a novella called The Museum of Dr. Moses, which is a horror story. It's about a woman, and she has a certain adventure, but she does triumph in the end. And this would be the graphic novel, if it ever evolves into it really happening.
Patty, thanks for calling. Joyce Carlos, I want to ask you about a couple of things. First, we're going to talk in a few minutes here about the story of Christopher Reeve. And as I thought about it this evening, it seemed, you know, and bless his soul, departed just yesterday after all his struggle with paralysis. But going from Superman to quadriplegic sounded almost like the stuff of a Joyce Carol Oates story.
Yes, that's very tragic, very, very sad. Of course, he was playing Superman, and Superman himself in the comic strip was a fantasy figure.
I also wondered what you thought when you heard, if you heard, this out of the most recent Dulfer report that President Bush ordered up on arms in Iraq. It turns out that Saddam Hussein was a fan of The Old Man and the Sea, and this was his favorite novel.
I didn't know that. That is so touching. It's very interesting.
He pictured himself as the old Cuban trying to reel in the fish. Can you picture Saddam Hussein reading that, reading you?
Well, we probably don't know who he is at all. We've had layers and layers of propaganda about these people, about the Iraqi people. And for all I know, everyone in the Mideast, we only know what we read in our newspapers and through the media. And I'm sure it's propaganda. During World War II, we were told what the Japanese and the Germans were like. And then later on, the Japanese and Germans became our allies. And so it goes, you know. So whoever Saddam Hussein is, I think we won't know until some time goes by.
Joyce Carol Oates, it's been wonderful having some time with you this evening. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Your next book, you said, was what? Missing Mom.
It won't be done. It's just finished now. It won't come out till 2005.
Well, we'll watch for it. And right now, on the shelves, The Falls, Over the Falls, in the first few pages, and right on it goes from there, from Niagara to the Love Canal. Joyce Carol Oates, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Joyce Carol Oates joined us from San Francisco. She's the winner of the National Book Award and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, author of more than 30 novels, including Blonde and We Were the Mulvaneys, distinguished professor of humanities at Princeton University. Her new novel is The Falls. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, the life and legacy of actor Christopher Reeve. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Actor Christopher Reeve died last night. The leading man who leapt to global fame playing Superman before being paralyzed from the shoulders down in a 1995 fall from a horse was 52. Reeve's death was caused by an infection from a pressure wound, a common complication among people living with paralysis. Christopher Reeve had never stopped trying to overcome that paralysis.
I was expected not to be able to move ever below my shoulders, but I just wasn't ready to accept that.
Since his writing accident, Reeve had campaigned aggressively for funding for research to help others like him and to combat neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's, and he had lobbied loudly for federal support of large-scale stem cell research, a controversial topic that has made its way into this year's presidential campaign. Joining me now from St. Louis is Dr. John McDonald of Washington University's Spinal Cord Injury Program. Dr. McDonald had a close personal and professional relationship with Christopher Reeve. Dr. McDonald, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
And joining us from Los Angeles is LA Weekly Hollywood columnist Nikki Fink, who closely followed Christopher Reeve's career. Nikki Fink, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Nikki Fink, if you'd be good enough first, just to remind us of Christopher Reeve's acting career before that terrible day in 1995 when he was doing the jumps with his horse, the horse fell. That was for a time at least, the end of that. But how had his career, how had it come up and how had it opened up before that time?
Well, he was 6'4", and he was beautiful. And he studied at Cornell University. And people forget that he went to Juilliard, one of only two students selected from Cornell, along with Robin Williams. And they studied under John Houseman, very famous actor and director. And he went the route of most people who are that beautiful. He went to the soap operas. He was a bad guy on Love of Life. And his real break was on Broadway. He played opposite Katharine Hepburn in A Matter of Gravity. And it was then that he got a movie role, and then, of course, he got Superman. But what's interesting about Chris Reeve is that he, after the Superman series was so successful, he really didn't want to just play beautiful men. Mm. He turned down the role in American Gigolo. He turned down the role in Body Heat. He turned down the role in Running Man. He turned down the role in Total Recall. It's very interesting when you think about that. He was really trying for more interesting roles. He had a wonderful deft touch with comedy in some movies like Switching Channels and Noises Off. Mm-hmm. He also could do very serious movies like Street Smart, where he was particularly adept. Somewhere in Time has become kind of a cult classic. Death Trap, he was marvelous. It was both comedy and drama. The Bostonians. And when, in 1993, not long before the accident, he got wonderful reviews for his performance in Remains of the Day with Emma Thompson and Tony Hopkins.
And as you say, he was determined throughout to, as he put it, escape the cape of Superman. He wasn't going to go into that typecasting direction, though it was a very powerful, popular image that stuck with him. I want to listen for a second. The last film that Christopher Reeve made before his accident was the 1995 thriller Above Suspicion. He played Dempsey Kane, a policeman paralyzed in a shooting and unable to walk. In an interview that he made while making the film, Reeve talked about the psychological effect that paralysis might have on a man.
The change that would happen, if you take somebody who's, 6'4" and a football player who has been able to ride a bike really fast and has been able to always do the things that he's used to doing, and for him to face the fact that for the rest of his life he's going to see the world from 3 feet high and he's going to be in a wheelchair, and the psychological effect of that is profound.
Of course, that was Christopher Reeve's destiny after the riding accident in Virginia. Dr. John McDonald, I wonder when you first came into the life of the paralyzed Christopher Reeve, and who was the man you found when you connected with him there?
Yeah, it was really, although I knew him before 1999, it was really primarily in 1999 that we began working with him in regards to his rehabilitation program. And who I found at that time is, someone with quite a bit of experience, who's grown a lot, and was searching out for different therapies to enhance his recovery of function. And someone who was quite sophisticated in doing so, although very ambitious in searching those out, he was quite cautious in deciding which ones that he would entertain.
Now, can you describe the injury that Christopher Reeve sustained in 1995, Dr. McDonald?
Yeah, he had an injury that involved him basically catapulting off a horse, landing on his head, and then resulting in extension of his neck such that he fractured the upper vertebrae of his spine at the C2 level. And that's usually an injury that's non-survivable because it instantly stops your ability to breathe. So most individuals would die within the first several minutes. But there was a person at the event that was able to resuscitate him and allowed him to survive past that point.
I read in a New Yorker, article on Reeve that if he had landed 1/16th of an inch to the left, he would have died from that fall. Maybe the same distance to the right, it would have only been a concussion. He would have been back on his feet within weeks. How does the physiologically, what happened from that accident to everything below his shoulders?
Yeah, I mean, basically what happens is the spinal cord is pinched by the broken bones, and that rapidly starts swelling and creates a lack of blood flow and a secondary stroke, and the cord starts to die from the inside out, and you're left with a variable donut-like rim of tissue that remains that allows some minimal function to get through. And in Chris's case, what was unusual is that he really literally had no function below that level of the injury and no really substantial recovery of function in the several years following his injury, which really normally connotes a severe prognosis in that, you know, no one's ever reported a human being recovering substantial function thereafter.
But he did recover function, though in the early days after that fall, he was very forthright later in saying that he thought about suicide. Let's listen to that.
You have the thought, maybe it's not worth everybody's trouble. And I had that thought for maybe 10 minutes. I suggested maybe I should just check out. And then Dana said to me, "You're still you, and I love you."
Christopher Reeve talking after his accident about how hard it was to stand up and go on, but he did. Nikki Fink, what was the structure around Christopher Reeve after this accident? He'd been very successful. He had resources. What was the texture of his life?
Well, of course, it was really divided into different levels. First, it was causes. He threw himself into developing with an insurance company catastrophic coverage for people, because I think his accident certainly had anybody who was a baby boomer and seemingly healthy realizing that anything at any point could happen.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the spinal cord research that he championed, and he and his wife set up different programs for that. There was the stem cell research. But before, he'd always been cause-minded. People forget that the Superman IV movie, Christopher Reeve helped write, and the story was his about nuclear proliferation and the dangers of it. He also was a very active environmentalist. And the other side of his life was getting back to work. And Hollywood just really gravitated towards him, his heroism in facing this, and really helped him get back to work. In fact, he won a Screen Actors Guild Award for his portrayal in a TV remake of Rear Window, mm-hmm. the famed Alfred Hitchcock movie. And he directed, he has a movie coming out on the A&E cable network on October 25th, and that's about a girl who suffers at 11 years old a severe spinal cord injury and how she overcomes it and goes to Harvard and really gets her life back on track.
But he became a real campaigner, first for his own recovery and then for broader causes. Dr. McDonald, can you describe how typical or atypical Christopher Reeve was in his pursuit of a return to body functions and how he succeeded, where he didn't succeed?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in general, everyone attempts to, you know, reintegrate back into society in a way that's meaningful. And, you know, he really did a wonderful job of entering into that very, very early, so much to the point where it interfered really with his continuing and ongoing rehabilitation, and then rededicated himself to that rehabilitative approach where then he started regaining that function. And then I think even later, you know, again, you know, devoting himself to the political environment to the point that to his own personal, you know, health detriment.
How much function did he regain, and how unusual was it?
It was really exceptional in the sense that really no one has ever reported a human case recovering that much function that long after an injury in such a worst-case scenario injury.
Please hang up and try your call.
He he recovered the ability to basically feel throughout his entire body and localize pain and touch as well as move most of his joints, which is really unheard of.
And how did that happen? Did tissue materially reform, or was it somehow just reinvigorated? What actually went on?
Well, it's not clear, and it's difficult to say within, of course, any individual, but if I were to speculate, I think most scientists would agree that they would say that there was some regeneration that would need to occur, but that there's always some remaining connections and tissue at the borders of that injured spinal cord, that if we simply take advantage of that remaining tissue and help restore function, then we can regain important bodily functions.
Dr. McDonald, you're famed for your stem cell research, and Christopher Reeve was a strong campaigner for stem cell research. Did he have stem cell treatment at all?
No, he had no, administration of stem cells or any other formal treatment like that, other than this advanced rehabilitative treatment, which we believe can actually mobilize the body's own ability to mobilize its stem cells.
And what did he expect or hope might one day come from stem cell research? Why did he push so hard for it?
Well, I think that he saw the vision within the stem cells that their importance is well beyond their immediate target as a therapy, but that embryonic stem cells, for example, are the basis of transgenic mice and animals that have revolutionized neuroscience, making discoveries possible that weren't even possible 10 years ago. And that's the proven benefit that embryonic stem cells already offer. And he could clearly see that.
Christopher Reeve was very tough on the Bush administration and its policy on stem cell research.
I think the administration has set back progress on stem cell research in this country by years, if not decades. It's much easier when the government's behind it. We really need full federal support, and we need to untie the hands of scientists here.
Christopher Reeve, very political there. Nikki Fink, I'm sorry we lost you for a minute. Christopher Reeve once said research should not be reckless, but it does need to be fearless. He was absolutely passionate about this. Every time I saw him on the air, the intensity was almost overwhelming.
Absolutely. Well, there is a Christopher Reeve paralysis.
Support for this program.
Hello?
Yes, we're here, Nikki. Please go ahead.
There was a Christopher Reeve Paralysis Act that goes before Congress this fall, and this was something that Reeve had labored tirelessly for spinal cord injury patients. And on the issue of stem cells, he did an interview with Reader's Digest magazine just a month ago, and he was talking about it, and he was talking about this question of opposition to embryonic stem cell research. And he said, it's incredibly hard to get a straight answer. And he feels that that you're supposed to, in research, try to do good for the greatest number of people. And he felt that religion was a real detriment to this, because religion should not be a factor in research. And that was his opinion, and his very strong opinion.
Well, he stuck with it, and he stuck with it strongly. To the end, a man without superstition. His daughter, Alexandria, was captain of Yale's polo team. That means on horseback. Christopher Reeve, dead yesterday at age 52. Dr. John McDonald at the Washington University School of Medicine, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
And Nikki Fink in Los Angeles, Hollywood business columnist at the LA Weekly, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.